that subsidizes through tax credits or something else or a state program. Again, that's a nuance that gets lost, and I think a primer at the public hearing just on how we finance and the range of investments we make depending on the project, I think helps set that conversation.
That's very helpful. As part of that, I think we do need to discuss what's going to happen at the federal level, because you know, certainly some of the candidates were saying they were completely going to get rid of the Housing and Urban Development Department.
Well, there's one piece of good news, which is, and we know this from Senator Wyden and his team, the Republican senators who have influence like the low-income tax credit program. They like the Section 8 program. They like the market-based programs. Now, those programs are also have great inefficiencies, and one of the reasons our costs go up in some of these projects is the costs associated with administering tax credit programs. But the Republicans do like those programs, so at least we have a fighting chance on those. Other kinds of subsidies, who knows?
I'm glad to hear that. Thank you.
I was just going to comment that in many jurisdictions, the city council will debate the question of whether the gap should be calibrated on the city share or the total gap made up by all sources. Put another way, developers, again, who are quite skilled and creative, could use the 4% low-income housing tax credit and the private activity tax exempt bond program, which will be more advantageous as interest rates continue to rise, to help defray their own costs of compliance. And none of that was modeled by us. So I think this debate is very real. I think the optics of it, if you will, which is I think what you're referring to, Commissioner, is very real. What might be helpful is in the work Nora and the panel of experts has done, you have some very real numbers on 2016 development costs by all types of residential prototypes, and you can contrast those to what the Bureau's projects are producing, and my guess is you'll find great comparability by product type, by prototype, if you will.
So, moving to slide 12, at the bottom of page 6, what you see here is the mixed-use zones feasibility. And as we've referenced before, this is calculated based on what's called a residual land value analysis. And essentially, for folks who are unfamiliar with residual land value analysis, you can think of it as after taking into consideration the cost of developing the building itself and the required profit for a developer and the investors of capital and debt, the amount of money a developer would be willing to pay for a price of land and still build the building. So what you see on the left is a market rate building. And for this prototype, again, this is the CM2 zone, which is where we expect most development in the mixed use zones over the next 19 years from now until 2035. And through the feasibility analysis and the panel process of informing the development of prototypes to do the economic study, we found that on average at market, a developer would be willing to pay $70 per square foot of site area of land and still build a building based on construction costs and required rates of return. The middle column you see is the modified recommendation from Commissioner Saltzman, which is 15% of units at 80% AMI until 2019. And with the reduction in revenue due to affordable rents in the building, you see that residual land value drop to $40. And so a developer would be willing to pay no more than $40-something for land if they wanted to preserve, again, the same profitability and they had the same cost of construction.
Could you just what assumption did you make about profitability?
Nora, can you speak a little bit about profitability assumptions?
Because we were told in a previous work session that it's generally between 8 and 15%. So I'm just wondering what number were these... figures calculated on, and again, does this build in long-term profitability, and it's at what level for the new owner?
Well, when you do a land residual analysis, you're looking at a particular point in time, and it capitalizes the net operating income of the building. So that does look at the profitability over the course of the life of the building. We also did IRR analysis internal rate of return analysis, which is a cash flow analysis for 20 years looking at the effect of when the property tax exemption dropped off, because we wanted to see. And we saw that that did not have a large impact on the IRR. I was looking for the, I'm trying to remember the return because we used several. Let me find it.
Okay. The challenge is for each development prototype, we've got six different scenarios, six different cost points, and two different return rates. And so we looked at them and then did our best to match them to what we see happening in the market. And so what you see here, and then similarly for the modified 60%, the deeper affordability option, you see that the residual land value analysis would yield a roughly $60 per square foot of site area price of land that a developer would be willing to pay if they wanted to, again, retain the same return and they had the same development cost. And so working with staff from the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, we modeled what, on a per square foot of land basis, the value of exempting the parking requirements would be. And I think this may speak to some earlier questions. And it's about $30 per square foot. And another way to think of it is that regardless of what the market may develop, the parking requirements that are in the current zoning code impose a $30 per square foot of site area cost with respect to parking.
Is that regardless of whether it's a 20-unit development or a 120-unit?
So we assumed for each of our prototypes that the building would be as large as feasibly possible, within the height and setback and step back and zoning regulations.
The cost of parking remains constant?
Unless it triggers like underground parking. But I believe in the CM2, we're looking at tuck under parking.
When we did the parking regulations in the last administration, the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability had did some similar things and came up with the same answer.
So the returns we assumed was 25% of development costs, and that included on the land as well. So we backed out 25% return on the development hard costs and 25% on the land cost as well, and backing into the residual land value.
All these numbers are built on the developer getting 25% profit from the construction.
Well, yeah, depending on your definition of profit, but yes, this is a 25% return on cost.
And why did you choose that?
That was in conversation with the panel of experts and the feeling that that's a minimum for the given level of risk of the types of developments that we're talking about here.
So in other words, if it was lower than that, your expectation is that people would just build less? Or elsewhere?
Yeah, they'd look to where they could get the highest return of comparable investment opportunities.
So, again, looking at the concerns that were raised by the panel of experts as well as the members of the Planning and Sustainability Commission, we feel that adjusting the inclusion rate for a two-year period of time and the addition of the exemption of parking requirements does provide a pathway for a developer to either return to the residual land value of a market rate building or choose to modify some amount of parking or construction cost and still move forward with the development project in the mixed-use zones.
So on the issue of the ramp-up, we got a document from something called Oregon Locus, Responsible Real Estate Developers and Investors, that argued for a much slower ramp-up. They said that we should start with a 3% inclusion rate for mixed-use zones and a 10% inclusion rate for zones with base FAR above 5.0 and gradually ramp up. And they made some reference to a ramp-up period, longer ramp-up period is important to give predictability and prevent investor jitters. And I recall seeing Joe Courtwright, a local economist, say something about the desirability of a longer ramp-up time in some comment he made recently. Could you address, why you think that their arguments for a longer ramp-up period are misguided and why you think that this would work?
Well, working with Planning and Sustainability and the Bureau of Development Services, we've been looking at which projects and at what rate projects are becoming vested. And we're seeing about a 300% increase in permit flow. So by February 1st, the projected effective date of this new policy, you'll have over a three-year supply of product already vested under the old rules. So in effect, we're already, by virtue of having an open, transparent, deliberative process, we're already giving people fair notice and warning, and they have themselves created their own ramp-up period. During that period of time, we'll do an evaluation of the calibration at year two, and that'll take into account those vested projects proceeding, since they have 3 years in which to pull their permits. So I think
just share with everybody what you told me the number was.
It's about 16,000.
16,000 permits have been applied for at this point, or at least a pre-app.
So the last 2 years, so in 2014 and 2015, the city saw about 4,500 to 5,000 multifamily permits. And at last check, which was the beginning of November, I think it was we pulled the data the week before the election, there were 14,000 unique multifamily units in the pipeline, and it's because there's both the permitting application process and the land use review process. So it's, close to 300% the normal volume, and we anticipate more units moving through the process before February 1.
David, if we adopt this policy and make it retroactive a year, any legal issues that you can think of?
I haven't studied Oregon law in this matter. I think the issue, to answer your question of ramp-up, is a political issue, not an economic issue. I think it's really a matter of the policy agreement that a city council among its colleagues makes, among yourselves, frankly, and with the stakeholders to whom you're accountable. Put another way, a real estate attorney, highly... deeply experienced attorney in New York City, one of the most complex zoning environments imaginable, once told me that when the New York City Planning Commission adopts an action at 2 a.m., land values adjust by 2:01.
In the New York Minute, another way?
Yeah, that was a New York Minute. We've seen that. I used the phrase certainty before, and I do think certainty is a value in a development context. So to the lack of certainty injects risk. So when you're clear on the rules, you're taking away a fair amount of risk. And by remaining clear and consistent, and that's why this is so important to embed in the zoning code, right? And hopefully this will be long-term policy, given your vision, Commissioner, for the city as a place of economic integration for all to live, work, and go to school. Would be stable. To continually change the rules would inject a lot of risk and uncertainty in the marketplace.
Well, to that point, to return again to the question of the cap on tax exemptions, if we adopt a policy that in effect assumes that the cap on tax exemptions is going to be lifted to a certain level before we have agreement from the county and the school districts, it seems that that would inject a significant amount of uncertainty.
So we've looked at what we would estimate the need for the full tax exemption to be. I know that the commissioner has had a discussion with Chair Kifori. Our estimate is $4.2 million per year, particularly in the initial years. What we see currently in our multi-program is about one-third of the tax exemption approvals that move through City Council are not subject to the cap. Because part of the agreement with the county is that if a tax exemption is approved in an urban renewal area, it doesn't apply to the $3 million cap. So even if we were to talk about full utilization of our voluntary program now, while the cap is set at $3 million, it would get close to $4 or $4.5 million, depending on the location of the building.
You said in the initial years, does it go up in the out years?
Well, at some point you're going to need to take into consideration the urban renewal areas going away. And I think the urban renewal areas will officially expire and the debt will be repaid in the mid-2020s. So at that point, we would no longer have the scenario where a tax exemption approved in an urban renewal area doesn't apply to a cap that's agreed to by the jurisdictions.
David and Nora, what are your thoughts about that? If we think that we have room over the next few years with the $3 million, but then when the urban renewal areas expire in the early 2020s, then it'll be unclear whether we continue with the tax exemption. Is that something we should worry about or not?
Um, I guess my answer is the market will adjust to a range of changing circumstances, like the cost of money. If it's the policy of the Portland City Council to entirely offset a calculated economic effect at a point in time, then it would almost obligate you to recalibrate that annually, which, taken with my earlier comment, would frankly inject a lot of uncertainty, would be politically hugely painful for the city council and your successors, and probably wouldn't be good public policy. You'd be attempting to guess where markets are going based on lots of variables that get injected. As I said in my introduction, we've never encountered a jurisdiction in our practice that sought, as a matter of policy, to offset 100% of the effect, but rather to provide developers a kit of tools, and they can root around in those tools. In some cases, parking may be really material. In other cases, developers want the parking because it's a marketing issue for the market they're trying to aim at, and they fight the city to get more parking, frankly. We've seen that often. So what might be deemed good public policy might not make good market sense for a market-rate residential developer. So I think my bottom line advice to you is not to attempt to finally calibrate a point in time in a marketplace that by definition is dynamic. And when you look at the price swings in land in Portland, is, I would characterize, hugely volatile. I think it's a fool's errand for you to attempt to guess. And I'm certainly not going to advise you to guess that. I'm not going to guess where things are going to be 2, 3, 4 years from now.
And with respect to certainty, in the code and rule, so we're going to be bringing forth a number of updates to city code in Title 30 and Title 33 and an administrative rule in some of the tax code where our multi-program resides. And in there, it spells out the required rates of inclusion or deeper affordability options. It also spells out the incentives that are offered, approved by city council in exchange. And there is a provision that says, should the city not have the available incentive as defined in code, a building, a developer is not subject to the inclusionary requirement to provide that level of certainty.
Is it intended eventually for this to be the only program to incentive multifamily development, or are any of the other things that we currently have going to continue and potentially we have to look at double dipping or how it factors in?
We've designed this to align all of our programs together to reach maximum public benefit effect. So the only exception to that is that during this interregnum period where we have this big bubble of some 16,000 units that would otherwise be producing market rate housing at 3 times the current rate, we think that a lot of those will actually become voluntary 60% units because, for one, we don't think lenders are likely to finance all those units under current terms and conditions, that they'll have to be repriced given higher rates of interest. So we think that there will be some voluntary utilization of the program for this interim period of time. We want to make sure that we're flexible enough to respond to that demand.
I mean, again, in the spirit of giving you some context of 25 years of practice in lots of different markets, I don't think we've ever seen this type of rush to permit. Anywhere near, I mean, I was shocked when I heard this number. I think that does speak to Kurt's point that the market is already pricing in a ramp up period. I think it also speaks to the inability to guess, you know, where markets will go. We did a very comparable analysis, the most extensive in U.S. history at the time it was done for L.A., and at that point, no type 1 high-rise construction in LA was feasible, and we recommended against it. And within 18 months, tens of thousands of units of high-rise construction had been permitted because there was a slight shift in the demand economics of price. One thing we haven't emphasized here is this, and I don't want to be overly, suggest over-precision here because I think, again, that's a bit of a fool's errand, but the land residual model is highly sensitive to inputs. And so you change rent or sale pricing a little bit, and you get wide swings. Witness the LA example. There had been no type 1 construction for 20 years in LA. And overnight, literally, that market flipped. So I don't think we as economists and you as a sitting council are able to predict that, those types of swings.
On the issue of the tax exemption, I just want to flag that we got a memo from the city budget office yesterday saying that they estimate the cost of this proposal to the city general fund that grows from roughly $660,000 a year to $6.1 million a year. I assume that that referred to lost property taxes primarily, although they didn't say that. So I'd somebody like some clarification from CBO and from housing as to how to reconcile the assumption that 4.2 million will be enough with their assertion that 6.1 million in city general fund is going to be lost.
After, I know we're going to get into some time crunch here because you've got a couple of panels, but I see Andrew Scott's here, so I assume we're going to invite Andrew up at some point just to talk about his memo. Kurt? Well, I would like to.
We will respond to the memo in preparation for the December 8th.
Okay, but we had a work session yesterday where we were pretty flexible. I think as long as Andrew's here, I would like to give him an opportunity to come up because I have some questions.
So continuing to move through the presentation, in the central cities, slide 13, the recommendations have not been modified. The recommendation is that 20% of units at 80% of the area median income would be the mandatory inclusionary requirement, with a deeper affordability option of 10% of units at 60% AMI.
Could you tell me what does this map show? Because I can't read any of it.
Oh, it's a map of the central city boundary.
Why is one of it shaded and one of it not?
So one is zoning and one is FAR.
Oh, thank you.
And so the incentives that would be provided would be the density bonus. Currently, that was being conceptually put together as a part of the updates to the central city density bonus updates around trying to incentivize affordable units on a voluntary basis. A 10-year property tax exemption on the affordable units. But in the case where the base FAR is 5.0 or greater, which is the most likely scenario that would lead to steel and concrete construction, we would utilize the full tax exemption program, so a tax exemption on all residential units. The construction excise tax exemption would be levied on the affordable units, as well as a STC waivers on the affordable units below 60% AMI. On slide 16, you'll find the fee in lieu schedule. Again, the fee in lieu was calculated to net the city the amount of revenue it would take to build the same number of units that would have otherwise been provided on site should a developer have chosen to provide those units. And you'll see that it ranges between $27 and $30 per gross square foot. And again, that's based on the $100,000 per unit subsidy that the city traditionally provides for the acquisition of land and the development of affordable units, with the understanding that nonprofit and for-profit developers that use our direct financing program leverage that $100,000 to get other sources of funds.
On the SDC waivers, I just want to flag, actually, should have asked for this earlier, but PBOT did a quick estimate that they based on the CBO assumption of 382 affordable units per year, we'd see $770,000 per year of lost transportation SDC revenue. And I assume that Commissioner Fritz has asked the same question of parks, and we need to factor those into.
Yeah, several million for parks. And that is of concern because if these are the very units that really need parks facilities close to them, and we're not yet where we have the whole city covered.
No, certainly. You know, I think the one comment I would have there, and I think it's definitely something we can look at and model, and we'll work with CBO to provide numbers at the hearing, is that the current city's SDC waiver policy is a policy that's in place regardless of the source of the unit. So whether we used the bond money that was just passed or construction excise tax funds or urban renewal funds, the SDC waiver program doesn't discriminate based on the source of the affordable unit. And so if with a 10,000-unit production target that the Housing Bureau is trying to meet in the comp plan, if those units are 60% and below and the SDC waiver policy still exists per city council, then those revenue losses would still be there.
I think, though, we do need to have the policy question because, as we all know, both transportation and parks are greatly underfunded. And so since this is now going to be the norm rather than just the exception, that's proportionally a greater impact.
Certainly.
Well, I don't want to overly complicate this, but the impact on parks and transportation has a budget impact. The impact on the utilities may have a legal impact. So we have to also focus on both of those questions.
So then finally, looking at slide 17, what we see there is the feasibility analysis for specifically the 6.0 FAR Central City prototype. And so this is right where you would start to see buildings using the steel and concrete construction, and thus the incentive package would incorporate the full tax exemption on all residential units. And so you see there actually that with the use of the full tax exemption, the residual land value at the 20% at 80% AMI and the 10% at 60% could be higher than the market rate scenario. And this, again, depends on construction costs and returns. And as a side comment, I think we also see this validated through the significant uptick in the utilization of our voluntary multi-program in the central city. I think we're finding that given the current market reality, that this is a very attractive option.
It'd be very helpful to me at the hearing or before to get just an example project that would cost X dollars. What does it cost now? What's the developer's profit then? And what's the developer's profit under each of these scenarios?
Certainly.
At this point, we'd like to invite additional people to testify. We have Dr. Lisa Bates, who served on the panel of experts, Maggie Talmadge, who was on the panel of experts and also was a member of the Planning and Sustainability Commission, Sarah Zahn, who was on the panel of experts, thank you, and Catherine Schultz, who is the chair of the Planning and Sustainability Commission. So if you can all come on up. Maybe one of you can grab the seat at the end there. So Dr. Bates, we'll start with you and press the button at the base of the microphone.
Thanks. Thank you for having me. As Commissioner Saltzman mentioned, I've been on the panel of experts during this process. My placement there, I believe, is related to my expertise in housing economics and housing policy and not bringing that perspective. I think we've heard already about inclusionary zoning as a policy nationwide, but I'll just reiterate that certainly for myself, given the reputation of Oregon and Portland in particular for excellent planning and coordination of thinking about things like land use, transportation, and housing, that it was quite surprising to me upon arrival here that this SUL, which is not only very widespread but is considered a best practice nationwide for the provision of affordable housing, was not available. And I think that there are, because of that preemption by the state, there is, somewhat less experience or perhaps knowledge about the potential and the practices around inclusionary zoning here in this region. But again, I would reiterate, it's not only quite standard, but it's considered best practice as a highly flexible tool with many possible implementation mechanisms. That occurs across a wide variety of markets and has been used for as long as the urban growth boundary has been around, 40 years plus. And our very best economic research demonstrates that inclusionary zoning is not only effective at creating an affordable housing supply that is integrated into areas of opportunity, but that it's most effective when it's mandatory and that it does not have significant impacts on overall supply or prices in the market. And I think that is important to understand that that is what the broad research shows, again, across many market conditions and across a long period of time, across many business cycles. We spent quite a bit of time in the panel of experts, and maybe I'll just say a little bit more about what we did there, looking at the calibration of this policy. And I think David and Nora gave you the broad sweep of that and the explanation of looking at types of developments. I think that process has been actually much more thorough than is typical for thinking about our regulatory environment as it is and changes to our regulatory environment, right? All planning and zoning regulations affect the cost of development. how we understand those and think about how changing those affects cost of development and impacts on those, you know, is a project to do. So we started from what I think you've heard are actually quite conservative assumptions in terms of returns to developers and in terms of using prototypes and financial calibration that came from the development community via Eco Northwest. And those numbers, of course, are not, it's not a crystal ball, right? We don't have perfect foresight into what happens in the market as the market changes. We don't have perfect foresight into how every development works. But in the belief that, you know, businesses in the private market adapt and adjust their practices to regulations all the time, that we saw a way to calibrate a policy that would work in the development environment that we have. We have seen multiple versions of pro forma, multiple versions of development prototypes, both from DRA's analysis, but also brought forward by the developer group of Locus. And we were able to look at a live version of that spreadsheet in the meeting and see that be clicked through quite a bit. And I think what we could see from that is that that sample that was chosen by that group of developers to display to us has a widely variable set of costs and conditions that within the bounds of which, the upper and lower bounds of any particular parameter, lies a great gulf of possibility. So, you know, trying to be, I think, as transparent as possible for choosing the numbers, looking at a reasonable set of assumptions, and looking at multiple metrics of success for development, which I think is realistic to how development works, and sort of norming that again against this long experience and across many jurisdictions that the analysis team has looked at, that we can reasonably, I believe, move forward with the proposal that the Bureau is putting forward, particularly, again, given this long ramp-up period that we have. So I'll just close by, you know, reiterating again that this policy, while new to us here, is not new in the world, that we see the alignment, I think, of this policy with values that we hold in our city for how we provide housing across a wide spectrum of people, that if you work here, you should be able to live here. That as you know, our neighbors who are contributing here in the city, whether they're teachers, they're nurses, they're our staff and students at Portland State, who are in the 60 to 80% AMI range, who are increasingly being squeezed out of the city, that we have a tool that can not only make additional units available, but ensure that they are available integrated into all areas of our city. Certainly, as we talk about Northeast Portland, I sit on the North Northeast Strategy Advisory Commission, there is a lot of regret about the inability to have utilized a policy like this as we saw the significant new construction happening in Northeast Portland, and to think about the number of units that could have been created with a policy that, again, is very standard and almost a sort of course, best practice nationwide in the housing policy circles. So I think this is the right time to move this forward and sort of to pick up this opportunity that we have right now.
Thank you, Dr. Bates.
Dr. Bates, could I ask a couple questions? One is, you've looked at a lot of other jurisdictions. Can you say that this proposal is most similar to X jurisdiction in the rest of the country?
No, and I would say because, well, for one thing, it's, you know, it's 500 plus jurisdictions, each of which has a slightly different version of the policy. But also because of the particular sideboards that were placed by the state legislature, that this is a little bit unique in a way that, you know, there's sort of these pieces that must go together.
And I'm cheating and asking this question, but since you're here, we're considering the question of whether to allow for more middle density housing in what are now single family zones. I'm just curious as to whether you think that we should take a broad view or a narrow view of in what areas middle housing should be allowed.
Well, I would take a broad view of areas in which middle housing are allowed, and I think that's, you know, that's one of a number of sort of planks in the platform of housing policy to allow for multiple housing types in single family zones. Is not going to resolve all housing problems. To have inclusionary zoning is not going to resolve all housing problems, but, you know, combining many planks is the reality of where we are in housing policy in our nation. We don't have a national housing policy that is meant to, we don't actually have an intent to create affordable housing for all people. We don't do that. And so we do what we can with the planks and the tools that we have. For me, the connection to the conversation about middle housing is that, you know, the report from the development community is if we relax single-family zoning restrictions, we will stop all housing supply. Just as a reaction from some members of the development community is if we have inclusionary housing, we will stop all housing supply. And I think that's a reaction that is around change, right? So when regulations change, business practices have to change. Other development firms may be better suited to come into the area and do development. Some may be less well-suited to do this kind of development. That happens when we change the regulatory environment, but the research does not bear out that it creates significant impacts on overall housing availability.
Thank you for inviting me here today. Likewise, I was on the panel of experts, partially with my role on the Planning and Sustainability Commission, but I believe partly because of my role at the Coalition of Communities of Color and the perspective that I bring from a community of color perspective. So I know Catherine is going to get into quite a bit of the letter from the Planning and Sustainability Commission, so I won't go too much into depth on that. Instead, I'll focus a little more on my experience on the panel of experts and the perspective I brought there. So obviously we've all heard that IZ can be done. It's been done across hundreds of jurisdictions across this country. We can look at many reports, including inclusionary housing, creating and maintaining equitable communities, which was in the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy. And during the panel, we also established some policy goals based on aspects, some unique aspects of IZ, including the ability to get units on site and quickly, and to capitalize and leverage private capital. And at the same time, promoting economic integration and affirmatively furthering fair housing, which was something that, as my role at the Coalition, I'm very, very interested in. And as a resident of Portland, very interested in. And again, the program...
Maggie, based on what you just so eloquently said, I assume that you would agree with the idea that has been said, spoken by Kurt and others, that our preference should be to get them, get the units in new construction, and that should be a preference over the fee in lieu.
Correct. I think there, although there is a good balance of having the fee in lieu dollars target 60%, we do want the units built on site. There is a value to time, and I think that's lost if we build 4 or 5 years later. And I think also, you know, that the program can be calibrated across different jurisdictions, across different markets, across different geographies and neighborhoods, and I think that's a strength of the program. And again, Lisa talked about how much time we put into the panel of experts working since the legislative session, but of course, We've had community members, the city of Portland, working on this policy to repeal the ban on inclusionary zoning for years. And it's a tool that our community members brought to the city. They fought hard for this. And legislators, housing advocates, the development community negotiated over an agreement that they could all live with, which included very generous sideboards for the development community. Again, we've heard it's not very common to have such large offsets for an inclusionary program. And again, it was a program that was designed and negotiated so that it wouldn't dampen housing supply and that it would provide the opportunity for increased number of units affordable to 80 and 60% MFI. So we've gone through the negotiation in Salem. I think what I struggled to go back on, both on the panel of experts as well as on the PSC, is moving backwards, really on those sideboards we already set. And we've gone through or gone around and round and round on the numbers during the panel of experts, and I think we heard quite well that these numbers aren't perfect. You know, folks will argue that we need to get the numbers perfect, but they never will be. The market changes. We're always going to have different data. And I think that is the strength of the recalibration, is that we can adjust and land values will too. And developers can figure out how to leverage other tax credits to work their pro forma. We've also heard that land prices, residual land value across the city, and even in the same neighborhood, are widely different, and that there's really increased bidding and upbidding of land. And IZ is not going to affect that speculation. That's going to occur regardless. And I think the proposal we see in front of us today, it reflects a lot of the conversations we had at the panel of experts and at the Planning and Sustainability Commission. We saw that there were increased incentives in the central city, which makes sense given the cost of land and development, particularly given a lot of the heights. But the mixed-use zone was more questionable. And I think the proposal we see in here of a phased-in inclusion rate gets at that concern. But we can also go back again and say, we've got 16,000 units in the pipeline. We have a phased-in process already, right? We've got 3 years for development and land values to adjust. So I think one of the biggest points is so the PSC voted to hold the development community and developers harmless. I almost voted down the proposal. I struggled to have developers not pay their fair share, right? And that it may be profitable. We discussed what if we give too many incentives? What if we directly subsidize? And this is more profitable than market rate. Well, let's just claw that back. And I'm thinking, is that reasonable? Is it reasonable or realistic to claw back and adjust subsidies in a year, in 2 years? It goes back to, we haven't seen fully offsetting public policies like this here. We haven't seen fully subsidizing green building or public spaces requirements, or bike racks, or SDCs. So why are we doing it for affordable housing? That's what I, go ahead.
I just wanted to clarify, make sure I'm understanding. You did the numbers, and it's basically the developer's profit at 25% stays with all of these subsidies.
The proposal from the PSC was to entirely hold developers harmless so that there would be no feasibility gap. Even though we even heard from Locus and developers on the panel of experts that they could take at least a 10 to 20 basis point hit. But the PSC proposal went further and set made sure that there was zero feasibility gap.
What was the rationale for that?
I'll go ahead and clarify that. And yeah, I can either do it now or when in my talking points. It's up to you. Okay. Perfect.
Great. And I'm fearful, and I think we heard this across the PSC as well, if we do increase, if we do have an incentive package that fully funds any feasibility gap, where will those resources come from? Will that eat into programs that serve households at 30% MFI or below? Is that a policy precedent we want to set? And I think finally, I think we need to remember why we're doing this, right? We went to the legislature, we repealed the ban, we've worked on the panel of experts, it's gone through the PSC, City Council has supported the pursuit of this at the state level, because our communities need affordable housing. 60% of the city is rent burdened. And that's not just 0 to 30, it's not just 0 to 60, it's across the gamut. And frankly, after November, our city council has a greater responsibility to protect our communities, particularly low-income communities, communities of color, and middle-income communities. We're not going to see favorable policies from the federal level, and it's that much more important that our city council and our state government looks after the interests and needs of our most vulnerable communities, and not the profit margin of market rate or profit-driven industries. And we also need to see this policy in tandem with all the other policies we're addressing. We can't build affordable housing on the outskirts of town and then expect our low-income community members to drive very fuel-efficient vehicles into the central city for employment, thus undercutting our climate and transportation goals. We can't underpay the contractors that work on our housing and thus force those workers to move out to the move out of the city entirely. We have to look at the system holistically. And in terms of parking minimums, for example, our communities are largely lower income communities. Increasingly, millennials are transit dependent. So reducing the need for or the requirement of public or of parking would benefit and go in that direction. So thank you.
Thank you. We'll go with Catherine Schultz next, Chair of the Planning Sustainability.
Thank you. The PSC's deliberations were a reflection of our belief that we should enact an IZ policy for all of the reasons that Dr. Bates so beautifully articulated. But after listening to the testimony, which you'll get to hear as well, I'm sure, we had concerns about the proposal that was put before us. And the key to that in our deliberations was the premise that the cost to development from the program should not suppress development. We need developers to continue to build units to be able to actually put affordable units on the market. And if we cannot continue to entice or use developers as our partners, then the program will fail to not only bring on affordable units, but to meet all the other goals that we have, such as climate action, transportation, and our city growth policies. Just kind of as a side note, as an architect, I want to counter Kurt's comments a little bit here about developers making historical profits. I can give you multiple examples of projects that we're working on right now, multifamily housing projects, where we're seeing loans called in during construction because developers are not able to meet their financing, their project goals. They're running out of money. And a lot of this is due to higher construction costs, amongst other things. So while landowners may be making more due to the sale of their land prices going up, I think you need to be careful and understand that developers are not necessarily, and developers need to be our partners in this process.
I don't understand that. If they, all of this is built in with a 25% profit to the developer, how does that fit with what you just said?
I am not a development expert, so I'm going to let Sarah answer that for you, if you don't mind. But I think it's an excellent question. I can just see the ramifications of the projects we're working on. Kind of going back to the PSC did not have the confidence that the inclusion rates that are proposed had enough incentives to offset the cost of providing the affordable units. Therefore, we offered 9 recommendations in our letter, many of which the Housing Bureau has addressed, and I'm not going to review the ones that they've already addressed. I'm just going to focus on a few that were not addressed. Number one, we all strongly agreed that we should provide as many affordable units as possible, and that the program needs to be viable at both the 80-20 level as well as the 60-10 level. While it's, we definitely wanted to incentivize 60-10, we think the program needs to make sense at 80-20 as well, and that needs to happen in both the central city and in the mixed-use zones equally, which they've addressed by lowering the inclusion rate in the mixed-use zones. We also felt the incentives needed to sufficiently offset the cost of producing the affordable units to avoid creating the unacceptable risk of reducing the overall rate of development. So this is somewhat going to answering the question you're asking of Maggie. We didn't have the benefit of time to do all of the analysis we were asking for and would have liked to have thoughtfully done. And therefore, we didn't feel that we could confidently provide a recommendation on how to set a policy around what that gap should reasonably be. We were hearing one thing from DRA, the Housing Bureau's expert, another thing from Econoche West, another thing from developers, and honestly felt it was somewhere in between perhaps, but couldn't feel like we could give you an answer to that. Additionally, there are many proposed zoning code changes that are going to add to the cost of development that are not taken into account in any of the analyses. So this is the changes that are coming through the mixed-use zones and the Central City 2035 that we're deliberating on right now, that we feel many of these are important items that need to be addressed and included and thought through, yet may suffer or may not be able to be enacted because they're not looked at cohesively. Therefore, the majority, not all, and Maggie clarified she certainly was one that was opposed to this, we recommended closing that gap. And we just set it at fully funding as a place to start to look at then ramping up or phasing the program in the future due to so many unknowns that we couldn't answer for you. I know the Housing Bureau rebutted in their letter fully funding our recommendation, as we advised, by stating that it required the city to set profitability and overhead standards, which would be unacceptable. I personally agree with that, but that wasn't the point. I think what we were trying to say is, we would recommend closing the gap closer to a zero residual land value. It may or may not be in all cases. And then phasing in a higher cost to development as the program grows and developers kind of get used to how to implement it. So therefore, our recommendation was that the program kind of looked at first setting what that acceptable financial gap is. And maybe you all agree that it's DRA's 25%. Maybe you're going to, after you hear testimony from the development community, think it's more like 10%.
Maybe you think it's closer to zero.
It needs to be, I think, that understand first. And from there, identify all of the incentives that are on the table that can be offered up, which will then inform you as to what a reasonable inclusion rate is. Again, we're hoping you will fully fund it and provide all the find the incentives to provide what we're recommending as the inclusion rate at fully 80-20 and 60-10. I don't believe, personally, from reviewing Housing Bureau's proposal that's on the table today, that it kind of hits those standards quite yet. But, of course, as the PSC did not deliberate on that. We also recommend that you do not adopt the inclusion rates into Title 33 until the incentive package in Title 30 is fully determined and fully funded, so you understand what the county is going to really do.
Now, I think we heard from the earlier presentation that Title 33 and 30 language is going to come back together. So we'll, when we have the follow-up, but I think that's a significant issue, and I believe it was addressed, but let's make sure we clarify that.
And I think I've heard everybody's agreeing to that. I don't think there's any debate on that. I think the key is making sure that the inclusion rates and the supporting incentives are calibrated and unified, that the tax exemption program is sufficient to meet the program needs, and that's fully understood and fully funded, and that the density bonuses are properly examined. I think you've heard some testimony, you probably read it, about historic districts maybe not being calibrated correctly, and we're concerned about that. Additionally, we recommended that the in-lieu fee be used as an important relief valve when the program is out of calibration and as a phasing tool as we phase in the program. We were supportive of a lower fee, and they have Housing Bureau has proposed it for the mixed-use zone, but we think we are also recommending that be lowered in the central city as well as you phase in. And then lastly, as Commissioner Novak raised, we're concerned about the effects of the program on the creation of new family housing units, and we recommend that a study be undertaken to encourage the development of them so that more families have the option to live in our central city. I can attest to multiple projects that I've worked on where I've watched developers consciously reduce the size of units to one bedrooms and studios due to trying to fit into the multi-program as it's kind of crafted today. So I think we're taking a market rate situation that's already making it more expensive to build two bedroom units and bigger, and exacerbating it by some of the requirements that we're putting on the voluntary program, and I think it's only going to get exacerbated in the mandatory program. So I think we need to continue to look into that. I think that generally covers it.
Catherine, can I ask you a question? We get a lot of very thoughtful letters from your commission that we then take very seriously as part of our deliberations. And I don't think I've ever read a letter quite like this. And I want to take the temperature of how significant your concerns are, because a number of them I think we're going to resolve today, and a number you're sort of salting our debate. You're asking us to grapple with some things. I think that's very important. But this, when I got this letter, I went back and reread the first paragraph because it could have just as easily be written by saying we turned down the proposal, but there is a path to getting to yes if these conditions are met. Instead, you said it's unanimous recommendation in favor with conditions, but again, I've never read a letter from you that had conditions of this magnitude as part of a yes recommendation. So am I reading between the lines correctly, or am I overreading that point?
No, I think it's correct. I think the commission grappled with, as I was saying, kind of what the right balance was here. We felt very strongly we did not have the time to do the proper work that we would have really liked to have done, and therefore you're seeing that in the letter. And I think some commissioners would have voted, as you say, just the opposite way, no. But here are some conditions. But I think there was no doubt about it, support that we wanted to send forward to you saying, we believe a program should happen. We're supportive of a program. We just weren't convinced that the program on the table in front of us was correct.
Well, and to your point about it needs to pencil out in order to be effective, I don't think anyone disagrees with that. I mean, the idea is not to set up a self-defeating policy. It is to hit the sweet spot where we get the development we want and the housing we want, and people don't have the excuse that they can't afford to do it. But where that line is what we're going to be discussing.
Absolutely.
I guess going forward, the one thing that I'll want to sort of follow up with the commission, and hopefully when we have our hearing, is of the nine conditions, just having a sense of prioritization. I mean, you listed nine. I don't know whether they are from top to bottom or whether they're just all nine, but there might be some that you weight higher than others. And just having a sense of what are those that you think you consider essential to the success of the program, and what are sort of nice to have, and having a sense of the difference between the two. I won't put you on the spot now, but I...
Perfect. That's a great question.
But when you give someone nine conditions, it's going to be helpful for me to understand which of those conditions are the most fundamental, and are we getting closer to meeting the concerns through our deliberations. So,
fair enough.
Thank you.
Thanks, Catherine. Sarah?
Well, good morning, and thank you for having me. I'm Sarah Zahn, and I work at Girding Edlin. I served on the panel of experts. I also serve as the chair of the Portland Housing Advisory Commission. So thank you for having me today. Just to give a little bit of context, I've been involved in the discussions about inclusionary housing since Portland